Hello, everybody. My name is Megan Malady. I'm an assistant professor at the University of South Florida and Tampa General Hospital Cancer Institute with a specialty in lymphoma and cellular therapy. And I'm here with Soho Insider. And today we're going to be interviewing Tara Graff. Tara, do you want to introduce yourself?
Hi. Yes, thanks for having me. Yes, I'm Dr. Tara Graff. I am in Des Moines, Iowa. I practice at Mission Cancer and Blood, which recently joined forces with Iowa Healthcare. And I am the director of clinical trials here at Mission. I'm a lymphoma specialist as well. And I also lead our cellular therapy program here in Des Moines. So thanks for having me.
Yeah, we're really excited to have you. Today's podcast is going to focus around bispecific antibodies, which I know is a research interest of yours. I know a lot of our listeners are probably familiar with bispecific antibodies, but just briefly for those that are not, I wanted to know if you would just tell us a little bit about what is a bispecific antibody, how does it differ from historical immunotherapies, and what are some treatment, what are some challenges that this treatment modality poses?
So, you know, we're no strangers to immunotherapy, right? We've been using Rituxan and obinutuzumab for lymphoma for years, right? And we use, you know, now a lot of the PD-L1 inhibitors, right? We have pembrolizumab and nivolumab and evrimab, right? There was lots and lots of mabs, right? And so they're all using the immune system in some fashion, you know, targeting some marker on our immune cells to fight cancer. But what is so novel about a bispecific, I always use the analogy of a bispecific being like a matchmaker, and it's bringing, you know, the CD3 on the T cell together with the marker of choice that we're targeting on the malignant cell. You know, in our world in lymphoma, that's CD20, right? And so I say, hey, if it's a perfect match, fireworks happen. And those fireworks, you know, are those cytokines that are released by the T cells that we need, right? They're so, so important to that T cell mediated killing. But I always explain to patients and others when I'm, you know, lecturing, those cytokines also, though, can wreak havoc, right? That immune system, that balance is not always perfect. And we tend to, you know, over-exaggerate sometimes. And when that happens, we can see those unique side effects or those unique things about bispecifics, which we refer to as CRS or cytokine release syndrome or neurotoxicity with ICANS, right? So those are some things that are unique to bispecific antibodies that we don't deal with the other mAbs, right? So they're all immune mediated in some fashion, but definitely with their own unique toxicity profile that is so important to understand when using bispecifics.
Thank you. That's actually an amazing explanation. And I love your analogy of this matchmaker. That's I think I might have to steal that from you. So you published a paper in Blood last year outlining some consensus recommendations for the management of CD3, CD20 bispecific antibodies in particular in the management of those toxicities. Can you talk a little bit more about that and how these differ from the recommendations, for example, for the management of CAR T cell related therapy related toxicities? I think you kind of alluded to that these are very similar toxicity profiles, but are sometimes managed a little differently.
Yeah, they are managed differently. I mean, in the sense that, you know, when patients get CAR T, right? I mean, in the beginning, when we were first using agents like AxiCell, before we knew it was okay to, you know, give steroids or intervene with tocilizumab, patients had a lot of CRS, right? And they did very well and had, you know, long-term remissions, but they got sick. And again, everything is new when you've never done it before, right? And then you learn as you go. And I think we have done much better in the CAR T space with managing those toxicities, but the bispecifics are different. And yet, yes, they're doing T cell mediated killing. And yes, the CRS, you know, what to look for in terms of temperature changes and blood pressure changes, those parameters are the same, but they're not to the same level as we see with CAR T. You know, very few of our bispecifics have, thank God, you know, grade 3, grade 4 toxicities. And when they do have them, they're low, you know, 2, 3, 4% in most cases, especially in our non-Hodgkin's lymphoma space. A little bit different in myeloma and for small cell lung cancer, but still manageable. And when I say manageable, to the point that we can do these outpatient, right? If you have the appropriate training of staff and monitoring programs in place, they can be done outpatient, where I don't think every patient getting a CAR can necessarily do that. Some centers potentially, some patients potentially, but in the bispecific world, you know, I've kept patients with fevers, you know, again, I'm not saying to do this, but I've managed grade 1 CRS with the patient at home, doing fine with very, very close monitoring and obviously, you know, communication. But I don't know if I would do that with a CAR T cell patient, right? It's just different. It's not the same. It's like CAR T light. So it's just a little bit different.
Thanks so much, Dr. Greffin. Along those lines, actually, one of the questions I had prepared for you is I was wondering how you are adjusting the pre-medications that you're giving with these bispecific antibodies and sort of in order to facilitate outpatient administration and ramp up, because I know that that's a research passion of yours and sort of an initiative that you've been sort of leading in our community and in the space for getting bispecific antibodies out into the community and in the outpatient setting.
So I think there's just little things that you can do. Obviously you can't take the risk away entirely. I think making sure that the patients are receiving IV dexamethasone. You know, when bispecifics first came out, we sort of had this loose, well, you could take oral dex at home before you come in. You can use IV dex. You can use prednisolone. You know, there was a kind of this, you can kind of do not what you want, but there was a little bit more leeway in what was going on. And then I think we've all kind of learned along the way that dex seems to be the steroid of choice in talking about pre-medication. And I think it's always best to administer it in the clinic or if their patient's in the hospital, but don't rely on a human to take it at home before they come in. I mean, that's asking a lot, right? In the day-to-day, what's going on? I think that's key. I'm also a really big fan of hydration. I honestly built into our protocols when we first started doing bispecifics 3 years ago, I'm like, I can't trust a human to drink because my bottle's been full all day long. And I think I've had 3 sips of water. So we get busy, life happens. And you can't tell someone to go home and please drink 2 liters of water. They're not going to do it. And so I decided into our electronic medical record, into the treatment, you know, the protocol, 1 liter of fluid pre while they're sitting there getting their pre-meds and 1 liter of fluid post. And I've done that for every bispecific we've used. And I will tell you that our rates of CRS are substantially lower than the general population that's reported in the studies. And I will get that published. I promise it's coming. But, it's anecdotal. It's easy. It's fluids. It's cheap. Again, you have to know your patient. You don't want to overload a heart failure patient. I just got done lecturing on that this morning in an in-service. Don't just throw fluids if the EF is like 39%. So you want to be mindful of that. But those are just little things, right? And patients, you know, also with some of the other bispecifics, and we're not really talking about lung cancer, but hydration seems to be key, even in several days post-infusion of, of Imdeltra. Again, I don't want to talk about lung cancer, but there really
seems... I have some questions.
Yeah, so we'll get to that then. But the hydration does seem to be key. And I don't let that go. It's so important. But also really making sure that all the patients are set home with a pill in the pocket dose of steroids. Because if they do have a mild temp and they can take steroids at home and you can follow them and they can sleep in their own bed, I mean, it's wonderful. Patients are so grateful for that. And I always say, make sure that the Tylenol and the ibuprofen that's in their medicine cabinet better be in date, because 1979 is probably not going to work. Yeah. So I always say that as a tidbit, make sure that what they have at home, we make sure that they have all the monitoring equipment, Tylenol, NSAIDs, if they can take NSAIDs, and their pill in the pocket. We make sure they bring them into the office, show us the bottles, show us their medical equipment, exhibit that they can use their medical equipment, because then and only then will I feel safe about them doing this as an outpatient.
Along those lines of monitoring, what role does your team utilize remote monitoring tools, and what role do you think that those are going to play moving forward as these therapies move into the outpatient setting and into the community?
So that's a great question. Right now, I have yet to find an e-pro that can take the place of a human. But I'm working with but I have in contact with different companies, and I am working on a few other things to figure out, you know, how can AI or how can that work, but also cut down the time of being alerted. Like right now, I have a bispecific team, which is not feasible to have what I have around the country. I mean, I know that I have like struck gold with these people on this team, but they run the show and they take full initiative, full responsibility. And so for, you know, all through step-up dosing, for all the bispecifics, they are the ones doing the calls. We're not letting the patient call us. I mean, if it's in between monitoring calls, they call us. I don't mean that, but there are set time frames every 6 hours during the highest risk days for step-up dosing. and they're called. And we have this beautiful email thread that just kind of goes through and every single call is reported. And it allows us to communicate, open communication, know what's going on with the patient. But I'm so lucky. But like this week, we had like four patients going simultaneously. And so the one person's on the phone for like, you know, half the night because of making the calls. And I mean, I'm exaggerating, but it's a great system. It's allowed us to have a very robust program. We have a huge commercial usage of the bispecifics, but also several clinical trials. So we're always going. And I provide education. I do in services at least every quarter to our teams. I did one this morning, just really reiterating the importances. Here's what we've learned. Here's some mistakes that we've made. Nothing that's led to anything major, but things to improve on in terms of best practices. When you're talking about teams that maybe aren't as experienced, you know, and that's what I try to do for community sites across the country is empower them and show them they can do this. But there's just some extra steps along the way to being able to do that.
Well, that's actually a great segue into my next question, which was, you know, you just outlined this robust infrastructure and support system that you have in order to administer bispecific antibodies. But one of the things that you highlighted is that, you know, bispecific antibodies have similar toxicity profiles, but to less severity, less incidence of occurrence than CAR T cell therapy. And so a huge selling point of bispecific antibodies is that they are able to be given in the community. Yeah. But obviously a lot of community centers don't have the robust infrastructure that you just outlined for your patients. So what recommendations would you give to a community physician looking to bring bispecific antibodies to their hematology oncology practice? And how do you see that happening more and more?
So, you know, one, I think it has to happen, right? Because bispecifics are here to stay, right? And it's not just in the heme malignancy space, right? It's in solid tumor. You know, we have them in small cell and we've got several trials going on in breast and non-small cell and prostate cancer and colon cancer. And so we're going to have to figure out how to do this, right? Because or we won't be able to practice. Because they're going to be here. And we can't refer everybody to an academic center because they're not going to be able to deal with all those numbers of patients. And so I try to, you know, encourage community sites that want to do this to actually reach out to other like-minded sites. I mean, you can take advice from the academic center, but it's different, right? It's not apples to apples. It's completely, it's like, you know, apple to a watermelon. It's completely different. And so I really think, hey, find a site, you know, find Dr. Graf, find a site that has done this, started from scratch, didn't have anything, wasn't part of an academic program, like did this as a true, honest community oncology practice and made it work. Any of you who've seen me speak, and I spoke at SoHo last year, I had this building block slide, right? And that is my slide. I always say, you know, you don't build a house from the roof down, right? It's the bricks in the middle that give it its solid nature and, you know, make it thrive year after year. And it's the same thing with my building blocks. You need to have those blocks. You can't decide on a Friday you're going to do this on a Monday. It takes months sometimes to have the hospital on board. Because even if we're doing it outpatient, you still have to have admitting privileges at the hospital in case a patient has to go into the hospital. We're not saying practice cowboy medicine and every single person has to do this outpatient. There are patients' social situations that warrant they have to be admitted because they don't have a caregiver, right? They don't have a car. I mean, like there's all sorts of things. And so that's a big thing. Logistics can get in the way of this. And that's unfortunate, but I also have experience in helping other sites, talking to their hospital administration, figuring out, explaining what we're doing. We're not asking them to pay for, you know, thousands of dollars of drug. We're asking for a bed. So I think it's just learning, right? You just have to build it up. Just put your blocks in order, figure out what your strengths and weaknesses are, and then reach out to people who've done this.
No, thank you. That's very helpful. And I think, you know, you sort of alluded to this, but one proposed mechanism for community physicians looking to bring bispecific antibodies to their practice is actually, and it's obviously more feasible depending on the geographic location, but is to partner with an academic institution because these toxicities are normally occurring within the first two cycles during what we call a dose ramp up, obviously, as you know. And so, you know, doing the dose ramp up at an academic institution where they're equipped to handle these toxicities when they occur, and then essentially transferring the patient back to the community to receive bispecific antibodies there after they're kind of outside of the window of CRS and ICANS. So I guess along the same lines of the last question I asked you, what advice would you give to an academic physician looking to kind of support his or her community oncologists in the area to sort of encourage them to bring these bispecific antibodies on, sort of like what it sounds like you're doing in your community? How can we support our community oncologists in adopting this therapy?
So one thing I was going to say to your last point is I've actually had other community sites send their patients to me for step-up dosing and then send them back, which is, it's nice, right? Because you're kind of collaborating. But to answer that question, I think, and I have some of my best friends are in the academic centers, and I was there too. And I, you know, for 11 years now, I've been in community, which is, I would say I wear two hats. I know both worlds. And so that's why I think I'm able to speak both languages and understand some of these intricacies, right? But I think don't assume, not my friends, because they're pretty good about this, but don't assume that community can't do it. I think there's still that mantra or still that thought out there that, well, community docs can't do this. Not that they don't, hey, let's help them do this, but they can't do that. And I think what I've done over the last 3 years and SoHo Doc Matters and all these different things that I've done, I think that that's starting to change a lot of the academic docs in lymphoma, their mind. They'll look at me like, oh my God, really? I love that because I think that I've almost set this path community can do this. Now, a two doc community practice in the middle of nowhere might be kind of hard, right? I mean, I'm not saying every single site in the whole entire world can do this, but the majority of sites, I think with the proper, education and training and collaboration, like maybe they do have to go to an academic site for just a short period of time, but then give them right back, have an open communication line. But again, my main shtick, if I can, is saying, like, give us some credit. Like there are so many community sites that I know across the country where I've got friends at and that I've helped, they can do it and they are doing it. I mean, they are doing it. I can think of 25 groups right now across this country, community sites, not academic affiliated, that are doing this and doing it well. And so I think it's almost like, let us help out. Like, you're always helping us. Yeah. Let us help you, right? Let's take some of the burden of multiple consultations for bispecifics and venetoclax and God knows what else we send to the academic centers, right? So I think that would be my message is that, a lot of community sites can do this. So just give us the credit, right? Because I think that more and more the eagerness to do this is going to be there from the community sites. But sometimes right now they're like, no, I can't do that. But I think they can, and I think they will. And really they're going to have to. So that'd be my message.
No, I think that's an excellent message. And I agree. I think ultimately, even in the community sites that don't want to do the ramp up, I'm eagerly awaiting sending my patients back to the local community, because the whole benefit of bispecifics is that, patients don't have to be at an academic center for a prolonged period of time and they can receive treatment close to home. And so really working to support my colleagues in the community to adopt these therapies is, something I'm quite passionate about, and I've been very interested in sort of your platform about this. Okay, so along those lines, we've mentioned CAR T cell therapy. So heated debate. Bispecifics versus CAR T, where do you stand? Do you feel one's better than the other? Do you think that the landscape is shifting to one therapy versus the other? Or maybe is there just simply a time and a place for the application of each therapy? What are your thoughts here?
Yeah, I know, I love that question. I always say, is it a bispecific bonanza or is it a CAR T cartel? Like, I'm not sure, right? I think it really has to, you can't take that one. I have the photo for that one. I think what's really, it's hard because they're different. Like in diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, I think if you've got somebody who's relapsed quickly, right now we don't have a single agent bispecific approved second line in DLBCL. We've got combination, who knows what's coming, right? But I think right now, if you've relapsed in less than 12 months with a DLBCL and you're CAR T eligible, you go for CAR, right? You do that. But if you have follicular lymphoma and we have this amazing drugs, right? We've got this insane third line landscape, the second line, everything we've seen at the summer meetings and all the different trials. I mean, it's I don't want to use the word exciting time, because it you don't want to say that with cancer, though, but it is exciting. I mean, to be able to give your patients these novel therapies is amazing. So I think in the indolent lymphoma space, with follicular, where you know, you're kind of, it's kind of hanging out with you. I think bispecifics are really probably, they're my first choice over CAR, unless someone's 45 years old. You know, we all had those like one shot, off shot kind of younger FL patients, but, you know, and using one in NHL doesn't really ruin the other, which is different than we see in ALL. And, you know, I think the debate's still out in myeloma, but so I'm okay. Right. And, you know, I think sometimes they're a bridge to one, right? So sometimes the bispecific's a bridge. They have a great response to the bispecific. They don't need to go to CAR. I mean, so I think you're okay, you know, to utilize them. But I think it's going to be a bispecific versus CAR T world in all of the different disease states of lymphoma. But I don't think I would choose one over the other across the board. I think that they're, again, it's going to matter, you know, who the patient is, what the disease is, you know, and just taking all that information together.
No, I completely agree. I think there is some, obviously you're never supposed to do cross-trial comparisons, but when you look at bispecific antibodies in the third line setting compared to CAR T cell therapy in the third line setting, they do appear to be slightly less efficacious. So if I can reach for CAR T cell therapy, I am. But there are plenty of people where we cannot reach for CAR T cell therapy. You know, I feel very passionately about, you know, not never really deeming someone CAR T ineligible until they've been seen by a CAR T specialist.
Exactly. Yeah.
Because ultimately, you know, CAR T is given very differently in each center and really deserves the assessment from a CAR T specialist and sort of from that center to determine whether this patient can proceed. But in those patients that aren't eligible, even, you know, in the second line setting, you're mentioning of the combination of bispecific antibodies and chemotherapy or an alternative agent, I think is really opening the door for T cell engaging therapies for all patients in the second line setting, which is really exciting. Okay. So you kind of alluded to this, but bispecific antibodies have already been approved for the treatment of non-small cell lung cancer and extending into numerous other disease subtypes. I think we have a clinical trial looking at a bispecific antibody for gluten allergies. So looking to the future, how do you think hematologists can support their oncology colleagues, but more importantly, their colleagues in other specialties who probably, I mean, most of our oncology colleagues have at least heard about CRS and ICANS and know how to manage it somewhat, even if they don't do cell therapy. But some of our colleagues have never heard of these toxicities, never managed them before. So how can we educate our, you know, internal medicine colleagues, our neurology colleagues, as these treatments kind of expand into their disease space?
It's a good question. We talked about IMDELLTRA in small cell. There's more and more trials coming out for non-small cell and all the other solid tumors, but you're right. I have celiac. So if they find a bispecific for a gluten problem, I'm all over it. But that's the truth. Rheumatology is going to see CAR T and bispecifics. And who knows what's going to happen in sports medicine and all these other things when you're figuring out how to manipulate the immune system, right? I mean, that's what it's really about. We are using our own bodies. We each have our own individual tumor microenvironments, right? We do. And just immune microenvironments, like in the room space, right? So I think we are going to have to be, you know, the oncologists are going to have to figure out a way to just really, whether it's holding seminars or just letting people call us, like, you know, people call now about, you know, anticoagulation questions, right? I think that's what it's going to be like. Like, hey, I've got a patient here for their rheumatoid and I'm going to be giving this, you know, where's the guidelines? Where are your tables? What can I do? And I think we're just going to have to be, you know, open for those 3 o'clock calls, 5 o'clock calls on a Friday, 7 a.m. calls on a Saturday. No, I'm not on call anymore, but, you know, because we get them all the time about, do I have to hold this? Can I do this? And so I think we're just going to have to be patient and really help, because if we don't help, then all the specialists are going to wind up seeing all the other specialties patients. And, you know, there's no way we can do that. So I think it's just being patient and helping each other. And then again, this will become old hat and then something else will come out in the next 10 years, right? Because it's just an evolution of, it's new now and it won't be new later. So I think just helping each other, I think, is at the end of the day, the most important thing.
What a great message to kind of end on. Helping each other out, kind of supporting people as cellular therapy expands past the field of malignant hematology is kind of something I didn't realize I would ever get to see this early in my career. So really exciting time in the field of, you know, immunotherapies in general. So Dr. Graf, I just want to thank you again for joining us today on SoHo Insider. And it was a pleasure to have you.
Yeah. Thank you so much. You guys, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye.